Welcome to episode 81 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm John Hickner, another family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, also a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. I was watching the Tampa Bay Lightning beat the Montreal Canadiens last night in the Stanley Cup Finals and was reflecting about this is a very rich time period for sports going on right now. We've got the Euro Cup and Copa America Finals this weekend. We've got the Wimbledon Finals coming up. The Tour de France is hot and heavy. Baseball, we've got the Olympics coming up, professional lacrosse, and I'm sure there are probably some less important sports that are going on right now as well, but it's just a really great time if you're an enthusiast.
Yeah, I'm going to be rooting for England, and my Italian friends hopefully will forgive me that, but I'm looking forward to that match as well. Yeah, so on this podcast, we're going to highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or poems. If you want all of the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a poem every day, plus a great primary care reference, thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get, for a nominal fee, CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians just for listening to us. Just go to IAFP.com, click on online IAFP education webpage, and find our podcast. This week, LDL targets after stroke, guided antiplatelet therapy after PCI, updated colorectal cancer screening recommendations from the USPSTF, and the incidence of myocarditis after mRNA-based COVID vaccination. Kate, take us away.
Sure. So I'm going to talk about a study that I came to understand after I had a discussion with a stroke neurologist about a patient that we were both taking care of. So this comes from Amarenko and colleagues. So this study enrolled about 2,800 patients who had recently experienced an ischemic stroke within about the past 3 months and had a modified Rankin score of 0 to 3. So that's a score of disability after stroke, or these patients had had a TIA within the previous 15 days. All the patients also had to have atherosclerosis of an extracranial or intracranial cerebral artery or the aortic arch or had known coronary artery disease. So the patients were randomized to hyperlipidemia therapy to an LDL target of either less than 70 or randomized to a target of between 90 and 110. And then they were followed for a median of 3.5 years. And the primary outcome, this is important, was a composite of MACEs, including non-fatal cerebral infarction or stroke of undetermined origin, non-fatal myocardial infarction, hospitalization for unstable angina, followed by urgent coronary artery revascularization, TIA treated with urgent carotid revascularization, or cardiovascular death, which included sudden unexplained death. So that's at least 6 items that they had in their composite. And these aren't, you know, these are your usual MACEs, but the composite, that's a big composite. The composite in the end occurred in about 8.5%, 121 of the people who were randomized to less than 70, compared with 10.9%, about 156 of the people who were randomized to the 90 to 110 LDL goal, which was statistically significant. And that's not an insignificant difference for sure. However, none of the individual components of the composite were found to be statistically significant, including the most common events, including revascularization procedures and non-fatal strokes. The mean LDL achieved was 65 in the less than 70 group and 96 in the 90 to 110 group. So patients in the group randomized to less than 70 were a lot more likely to require a second drug, such as ezetimibe. That was the most common drug used when a second drug was required. So it worked, right? Patients in the group randomized to a lower LDL did achieve a lower LDL, but over 3 years, it didn't create a particularly large difference in MACEs. The difference was small enough that the researchers had to lump all of them together in order to see a difference. There were no significant adverse effects. And so this may be one that's right for some patients, but probably isn't right for all comers just yet. And that's where the stroke neurologist and I were discussing, is this something that should be indicated for all patients after they have a stroke, or is this one that would be indicated for some patients, but not everybody? Henry, what do you think?
Thanks for presenting this. This was a study that escaped my attention. For years, I've been ranting about guidelines that have extrapolated beyond the existing research around lipids, that most of the lipid studies for primary and secondary cardiac prevention have randomized patients to a specific dose of medication and looked at the rate of outcomes. And oh, by the way, these were the average levels of lipids that people achieved. Therefore, these should be the targets. And that's an extrapolation beyond the body of the research. And it assumes that the lipids are the cause of the events that people are experiencing. And that's a theory that has been challenged. In fact, a few years ago, the American College of Cardiology decided that, if you've got a patient based on Framingham risk score, similar comparable risk score that is at high risk of an event, you should put them on a high-dose statin and forget about the target levels. It was very refreshing, that fire and forget. This is the first study that I can think of where there has been an attempt to try to look at less rigorous control versus more rigorous control. What I'd love to see is a trial comparing target-based therapy versus dose-based therapy, because the fire and forget, frankly, is a whole lot easier and probably less expensive.
This is an interesting study, I think, in the sense that it pretty much confirms many other studies that have to do with lipid lowering in terms of the numbers needed to treat, especially. This seems to be a typical range of number of patients that you need to treat to get some sort of a good cardiac effect. These were fairly high-risk people, so it took somewhere between 40 and 70 to get a better event for one of those categories. So it says, can't you say, it's not a real impressive difference, it's a real difference. And I think it's useful information, and it seems to me that if it's possible and relatively easy to get to a lower target in these very high-risk patients, why not?
Yeah, I think that's really the key thing, is that if you can get someone to that, if they're tolerating a little bit higher dose of a statin, they're doing fine, or they don't mind taking an extra pill, sure. But also remember, these are patients with known coronary artery disease, not just anybody who happened to have a stroke. They're particularly high-risk group, so I think that has to be kept in mind. In a lower-risk group, you're probably going to see less benefit. So anyway, thanks, Kate. Great study. I had missed that one, too. I got to go back and add that one to poems, because I think I missed that one when I reviewed the New England Journal last year. So thanks for that. John, your turn to give us the quiz.
Yes, I have a little bit about COVID. We can't get away from COVID entirely because it is making a bit of a comeback, as we know, with the Delta variant. So here is this question. Approximately what percent of people with acute COVID-19 infection have persistent symptoms 6 months after infection? The options are A, 5%, B, 10%, C, 20%, and D, 30%. And stay tuned for the answer.
Thank you. And Henry, tell us a little bit about guided antiplatelet therapy. I want to learn what that is.
Thank you. This poem asks the question, do patients who undergo percutaneous coronary interventions, are they better off using guided antiplatelet therapy than standard therapy? And this was published by Galley and colleagues in Lancet just this past April. And this was a systematic review and meta-analysis, bonus, two for one. And they did a pretty reasonable job accumulating the studies and synthesizing the information. They had a few little judgment errors that I'll mention along the way. And so let me just start off with some definitions. So they defined guided therapy as any strategy that either uses platelet function testing or genetic testing to determine treatment. And then based on the test results, this guided therapy could include either escalation of medication or de-escalation. Now, escalation meant switching from their base scenario of everybody gets clopidogrel. So escalation would be you go from clopidogrel to one of the newer agents, doubling the dose or adding a second medication. And de-escalation involved switching to newer agents, specifically stopping the clopidogrel and using something like prasugrel or ticrelegore. So they used pretty, like I said, they used pretty good methods here and identified 11 randomized trials and 3 observational studies. They had just under 21,000 participants total. And the median follow-up was about 11 months, so relatively short term. Now, they only used the randomized trials to look at effectiveness, but they used all of the studies, randomized trials and observational studies, to look at potential harms. And that's a pretty reasonable approach. One of the hiccups that they identified was that the primary outcomes of major adverse cardiovascular events and bleeding was highly variable. The definitions used by the individual studies varied all over the map. Nonetheless, they chose to report those pooled data, but to their credit, they also tried to look at each of the individual events. So when they just looked at the total, the so-called MACE, what they found was that those who got the guided therapy, they actually had fewer MACEs than in the standard group, about a 1% absolute difference. So that translates into a number needed to treat of about 100. When they started to look at individual outcomes, they also found that guided therapy had small reductions in events, except for cardiovascular death. On the other hand, regardless of the study type, whether it was observational or randomized, the risk of any bleeding at all was comparable between the two groups, but minor bleeding, again, highly variable, occurred less frequently than with guided therapy. And not surprisingly, if you escalate therapy, meaning you put patients who are apparently inadequate and you escalate their dose, they have fewer MACEs. If it looks like they're being overtreated based on the guided therapy and you de-escalate, they had fewer bleeding problems. So this is sort of an interesting novel way of looking at things. The questions one might ask would be, could we have figured this out anyway? And then the challenges are that, you know, the formal testing can be expensive, and I'm not quite sure how many insurance companies are buying into this yet. Mark.
Yeah, but so can, you know, recurrent episodes of cardiovascular events can be expensive too. So I would think this is interesting stuff. I mean, it's not something that I've considered doing previously. And I think it's probably still a bit off the radar for most folks, but you know, it's definitely something to consider, particularly for folks where you're doing this for secondary prevention, and you know, the risk of a subsequent event is high. And an NNT of 100 for a year, if it is kind of a linear benefit, that's an NNT of 20 over 5 years, right? So, you know, I think that's another thing. This was a fairly short-term NNT. Kate?
Yeah, I'll take it a step further and say that in addition to it being off my radar, I'd never heard of this before, using bleeding times or genetic testing to guide therapy after PCI. So it's definitely something to think about and consider. I do worry a little bit about implementation. How do you make this available to everybody? And some of the concerns about using genetic testing in general, of just, I assume that this has to do with the how it's broken down and how that could affect the availability of the medication. But in some cases, you know, you get the medication the genetic availability of it doesn't actually correlate to the function of it. So you get this genetic testing result that doesn't actually correlate with the testing the function of the medication to the person. So it may not be, you know, as useful. Although I guess this is the trial that tells us, no, in fact, it's just as useful as it seems. So
yeah, it'll be interesting.
I found it fascinating that in this case, the observational studies did not show a difference, whereas the randomized trials did. And observational studies are usually more real life-like. So that worries me a bit, and also a pretty high number needed to treat of 105. So I'm pretty marginal about accepting this as the right thing to do. It seems like probably a very small benefit for what might be a large cost.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if this makes its way into the guidelines. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's my turn, and I get to talk about colorectal cancer screening. So this is the new recommendation statement from the USPSTF, and they updated their systematic review. This is actually the systematic review that supports their recommendation statement as well. They found 33 studies on the effectiveness of screening versus no screening for colorectal cancer, and they found a significant decrease in the risk of colorectal cancer mortality with screening. Now, there's no evidence that they cite to favor a specific screening method, although I will say that the only randomized trial data we have would support FlexSig and fecal occult blood testing, the old kind. And I'll also say that that combined stool DNA testing with fecal immunochemical testing, Cologuard, does result in more false positives, more follow-up colonoscopies, higher costs, and more adverse events, with no reduction in additional reduction in mortality compared to the FIT testing. So really my preference is FIT over Cologuard. And I think FIT and colonoscopy are the two primary choices we should be looking at. Clinicians and their patients should consider, you know, a lot of factors. So, you know, what's convenient, what's the cost, do they want to go through a prep? FIT doesn't require any kind of prep. It's just a single card in deciding what's best for each person. No study has found a significant reduction in all-cause mortality, although all of those studies have been underpowered for that outcome. Trends in all these studies favored reduced all-cause mortality. They was going in the same direction as the cancer mortality reduction. And modeling does support a reduction in all-cause mortality. Serious harm can result from screening or follow-up colonoscopy. We know that. Perforations, bleeding, that's more common in elderly patients in particular. And that's where the shared decision-making comes in once someone is over 75, whether you really want to continue colonoscopy, perhaps you switch to a FIT-based testing scheme at that point. So lots of other recommendations, other organizations have similar recommendations. The AAFP, American College of Physicians, Cancer Society. The AAFP, though, doesn't recommend starting before age 50. And that's what's new with this recommendation is that it used to be 50 to 75 was an A, and that's still the case. 75 to 85 was a C, that's still the case. But now they've added an intermediate B recommendation for screening adults age 45 to 49 years. So that's something to consider. And I think that's where patient preference, where risk, you know, perhaps familial risk for colorectal cancer, there are some risk scores you can use to determine that might come into play. If you do, my last comment is if you look around the world, we're the only country that really has predominantly chosen colonoscopy as its screening methodology. Germany does some of it. I think Luxembourg does some, but pretty much every other country does FIT testing as its primary screening modality. And as I've mentioned before, we do have randomized trials comparing FIT with colonoscopy that are going to be published in the next few years. And finally, remember, FIT is different from those older guaiac-based tests. If you haven't already, switch to FIT. They are fecal immunochemical tests. It's just a single card, and there's no dietary prep involved. John?
The big news here is lowering the age to 45. Mark, have other countries done this as well, or are other countries sticking with age 50?
I'm not aware of any other countries. I looked about 2 or 3 years ago, and at that point, none of them, I don't believe anybody started before 50. And in fact, a number of countries wait until I was in Ireland a couple of years ago, and there they just started their bowel screening program at age 60. And Canada, I think, begins at age 60 as well. So there are countries going older, but not younger, as far as I know. And this was driven by modeling data. There's actually no clinical data from in that age group. And it was driven by an increasing incidence in younger patients. But it's a little bit on the soft side in terms of, I would say, making that recommendation at this point.
Thanks.
Yeah, Kate?
Yeah, I happened to read this recommendation just recently, and one of the interesting things that I pulled out was that the average age of diagnosis was 68. So as a person on the younger end of this range, thank you, it did make me sort of stop and think, especially knowing that that's based on modeling data rather than clinical data, am I going to go ahead and start at 45, or am I going to be, you know, as an individual, not as a clinician, going to go ahead and say, I'm going to wait an extra couple of years, thinking that my chances of a false positive are probably higher than my chances of a true positive. Again, knowing that's probably true for most screening tests, but especially knowing that, you know, we're still going to be starting younger and younger.
Yeah, and on average, it's going to result in probably, you know, approximately one more lifetime colonoscopy per person. You know, that's a few thousand dollars. It's a pretty significant, you know, cost for the health system, and the marginal benefit is on the small side. And so, I'm not shocked by this decision to go to 45, but maybe a little bit surprised that they jumped on that. American Cancer Society has led the way. They were the first ones to say start at 45, and maybe that had some influence. I'm not sure, but it's an interesting bit of a leap, and I'm sure there'll be further discussion and further modeling and analysis and cost effectiveness studies and things like that. All right, good stuff. Henry, you have any comments on that one? Or
no, I think you've covered it pretty well. Thank you.
All right, good. Hey, John, tell us about myocarditis.
We've been hearing about this in the news for the last couple of weeks, so I was waiting for a good scientific study to come out to this issue of myocarditis after COVID immunization. And finally, it did just this past week in JAMA. So here it is. We know myocarditis has been described as a rare complication of COVID-19 immunization with the mRNA vaccines. This recent study from the U.S. military finally provides an estimate of the frequency of this adverse event, which is confined mostly to young males, almost exclusively. So in the military, from a total of 2.81 million doses of the mRNA viruses, during the study period, 23 men developed acute myocarditis within 4 days after receiving the vaccine, 3 cases after the first dose and 20 after the second dose. They all presented with symptoms, with acute chest pain, and subsequent testing then confirmed myocarditis with elevated troponin levels, abnormal EKGs, and in some cases, abnormal cardiac imaging. No other cause of the acute myocarditis was discovered on further evaluation, and all of the men recovered or were recovering at the time of this report, which was written in June of 2021. Just to help confirm that these cases were related to the COVID vaccine, the investigators calculated the expected number of acute myocarditis cases based on background population risk, that is prior data, and then compared that to the cases observed, the number of cases observed in this group of military men. They focused on the second immunization, since that was the most common cause of the myocarditis or association. So they had 4,396 second doses given to military men. One would have expected the background number of cases to be somewhere between 0 and 8. It's really difficult to get exact estimates, but they thought tops would be 8. But the observed number of cases, as I said, was 20. So given this elevated risk and the very temporal association, it seems highly likely that many of these cases of myocarditis were indeed due to the COVID-19 vaccines. However, the incidence of myocarditis with immunization, which if you do a little math, was approximately 4 to 5 cases per 100,000 immunizations in these young men, that's many times lower than the incidence of symptomatic myocarditis from COVID-19 described in a study of Big Ten Conference athletes, which are a comparable group of young men. In that group, the incidence was 313 cases per 100,000 cases of acute COVID infection. So many fold greater. So the bottom line is, yes, it looks like a real association, but boy, it's a whole lot safer than getting COVID if you're wanting to avoid myocarditis. Kate?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you know or can talk a little bit about the sex predilection here. Is this just not a condition that we see in women?
It's odd. In the articles I read several articles about this myocarditis, and none of them speculated about the biology of this. But there's got to be some biology at work, just as we saw more severe vascular reactions in young women to COVID vaccines. So very interesting. But the biologic basis, I have no idea, and nobody has speculated out loud.
All right. So
Henry.
Yeah, this is, I think your conclusions are probably correct, that immunization-based myocarditis is probably a whole lot less frequent than that which occurs with COVID. I'm a little bit skeptical, if you will, about the Big Ten data, And the reason for that is that the original report that came out of Ohio State University was really a very selected group of individuals that they actually had 26 people who had had COVID who chose to go on and have additional testing, just like in this EKG, echocardiogram, troponins, but they also, all of them had cardiac MRIs, which are not widely available. And in that study, there were four males who had signs of true myocarditis, but almost half of the participants also had this weird late gadolinium enhancement that they weren't quite sure what it meant, but they kind of all got lumped together and became the basis for the Big Ten's recommendation that all athletes who get COVID should be screened with cardiac MRI. So we may actually have inflated numeric data with regards to what the actual myocarditis rate is. I suspect, though, it is probably not 313 out of 100,000, and it's probably not nearly the four per 100,000 that you came up with. I suspect it's a lot, somewhere in between.
Just to argue a little bit with you, Henry, I took only the cases from that study in which the men had symptoms of myocarditis. There were a lot others that had no symptoms. So I took only those that had symptomatic myocarditis. They had chest pain, so that it was more comparable to this group. But you're right, 313 may be a little high, but at any rate, it's certainly higher than the immunization data.
Yeah, I think an important point is that the cases were all recovered or recovering at the time that this report was written. So it didn't appear like they were likely to be permanent sequelae. And, you know, whether it's 200 or 300 or 150, it's, you know, scores more cases, you know, 70, 40, 50, 60, 70 times more likelihood with an acute infection than with vaccination. So it's much safer to get the vaccine. I think that's really the important message for our patients, is that it is far more likely that you get myocarditis from the infection than from the vaccine. But there's always that sense of, you know, agency, and I want to, you know, I'm choosing to take this vaccine. I'm not choosing to get infected. Mm-hmm. And so that's right. Sort of the psychological component of this. But yeah, great study. Thanks. And important to get that word out. John, tell us about the answer to your quiz.
All right. The question again, approximately what percent of people with acute COVID-19 infection have persistent symptoms 6 months after infection, the so-called long haul syndrome? And the options were 5, 10, 20, and 30%. And the correct answer is an estimate. It appears to be around 30%. I based this answer on a study that invited 234 people who had COVID infection to complete a survey, and 177 did. And persistent symptoms in this group was reported by 27% of patients who were younger, age 70 to 64, 30% of patients, if you just cut it at 40 to 64, and 43% of patients age 65 and older. Now, unlike some other studies about the long haul syndrome, 85% of these people were outpatients. They had mild illness, and yet you can see that many of them still had symptoms. Only 9% of them were hospitalized. So overall, 33% of the outpatients and 31% of the hospitalized patients had persistent symptoms, a median of 6 months. So some people had symptoms much longer than that, some people a little bit less. Now, this is a problem because the CDC estimates that there are probably about 15 million Americans that are likely to have persistent COVID-19 symptoms. So you are going to see these people in your office. In fact, I'm sure most of you have already seen these people. One of my neighbors, an 80-year-old lady, had COVID and recovered and seemed to be doing okay. But a few months later, was hospitalized for a weird febrile illness that they could never diagnose. The best they could think of that this was a post-COVID syndrome, and she ended up in a wheelchair because of severe muscle weakness and some neurologic issues in her legs. So the deaths are one thing, but there are going to be a lot of patients out there that we need to deal with. And don't forget the chronic fatigue syndrome. Don't forget about post-Lyme syndrome. So this is not the first time that the medical system has been confronted with a post-infectious syndrome that is causing some havoc in our population.
Yeah, John, we just, in fact, about an hour ago, I posted our study on University of Georgia students, where we estimated a 42% prevalence of previous infection. And I just posted it to the MedArchive preprint server, so folks can actually find it there right now. But the another interesting thing was, of the 130 students who reported a symptomatic infection, 11% had persistent symptoms 6 months later. So that's in a young population. So I think the prevailing, you know, quote, wisdom among young people is, it's no big deal, I'll just get it and recover. But, you know, 1 in 9 were reporting persistent symptoms 6 months later. So we're actually about to do a much more in-depth follow-up of our students and see what we can learn about that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, interesting stuff. And I'm sure we'll be learning much more about this as we go along. Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks, Kate, Henry, and John. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Again, if you want to get CME credit, IAFP.com. Click on Online IAFP Education and look for our podcast. The IAFP is accredited by the ACME, ACCME, to provide CME for physicians. They designate this podcast for 1/2 AMA Category 1 credit. The IAFP adheres to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. You can read our complete disclosure on the IAFP website. Hope you enjoyed today's discussion, learned a little something. Please tell your friends, pass the word along. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.